morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Today is Wednesday, January the 12th. This morning on Daybreak Africa, an airstrike in Ethiopia's Tigray region has killed 17 civilians and wounded scores more, a day after U.S. President Joe Biden raised concerns about airstrikes in the Tigray region during a call with Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. And West African states imposed sanctions on Mali this week, but analysts say that ordinary Malians are also set to suffer.
Mali is an import-heavy economy. They do well relatively in terms of food subsistence, but other things have to be imported.
A Ugandan author who wrote critical comments about President Yoweri Museveni's son has been formally charged with offensive communications. But his lawyer says that they were not informed about his court appearance until the last minute.
This was a clandestine move intended to deny him an opportunity for legal representation and an opportunity to pursue his legal remedies like bail and opposing the charges, which are bogus.
And why are Kenyans calling for a boycott of the fast food giant KFC? Well, we have these stories and more coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. Stay tuned. And for our top story, an airstrike in northern Ethiopia's Tigray region has killed 17 civilians, mainly women, and wounded scores more. That is according to aid workers. As Gilmore Dawit reports from Addis Ababa, the strike came the same day U.S. President Joe Biden raised concerns about airstrikes on civilians with Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed.
The attack happened late Monday near Maizebri town in northwestern Tigray. A report by a local administration said women at flour grinding mill made up most of the killed, a source who saw the report told the Associated Press. Government Communication Minister Legese Tulu and the State Minister for the Government Communication Service Kabere Desisa did not respond to requests for comment. The attack happened same day U.S. President Joe Biden called Prime Minister Abiy and shared his concern about drone strikes causing civilian deaths in Tigray. He also called on government and Tigray People's Liberation Front, which has ruled Tigray for decades, to end hostilities, begin a national dialogue and open humanitarian access to Tigray. This is the second deadly airstrike reported in Tigray in less than a week. On Friday, aid groups said an airstrike on a displaced persons camp near the town of Dedevit, close to the Eritrean border, killed more than 50 and wounded 138 others. The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said 12 of those killed were children and that the airstrike destroyed temporary structures. The strike have disrupted aid delivery to Tigray. On Sunday, OCHA said aid partners delivering help in parts of Tigray have stopped operations due to insecurity. Gilmore Dawit for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
A Ugandan author who wrote critical comments about President Yoweri Museveni's son has been charged with offensive communications. Kakwenza Rukirabasaija's lawyer says that he was tortured in detention, as Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
Award-winning Ugandan writer Kakwenza Rukirabasaija appeared before a court Tuesday and was charged with two counts of offensive communication. Rukirabasaija was arrested on December 28th and taken from his Kampala home. The government says he was using his Twitter account to offend President Yoweri Museveni and his son, Commander of Land Forces, Lieutenant General Muhoozi Kainerugaba. The writer's lawyer, Aaron Kiza, tells VOA he was not made aware of his client's court appearance until later.
This was a clandestine move intended to deny him an opportunity for legal representation and an opportunity to pursue his legal remedies like bail and opposing the charges, which are bogus.
Rukirabasaija's court appearance comes a day after the High Court issued an order for it to take place before the close of business Wednesday. The magistrate Tuesday also issued an order for him to be subjected to a medical examination by prison authorities to ascertain his health status. During a January 3rd search at his home in Igenga district in the eastern region, the writer reportedly whispered to his wife that he had been tortured. Photos of his blood-stained stained undergarments were later posted on social media. The author was allegedly detained at the Special Forces Command facility in Entebbe, a claim the army vehemently denied. The award-winning writer has been remanded to a prison facility until January 21st, when he reappears before a court. This is the third time he has been arrested. The first time was in April 2020 for his novel, The Greedy Barbarian, a fictional account of high-level corruption. He was again arrested the following September for his second novel titled Banana Republic, which detailed torture. He won the Pen Pinter Prize International Writer of Courage Award in 2021. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala, Uganda.
West African sanctions imposed on Mali this week after the country's military government postponed elections, block all essential commercial and financial transactions. But while the punitive move aims to pressure the military to hold elections as promised in February, experts say that ordinary Malians are also set to suffer. Annie Reisenberg reports from Mali's capital, Bamako.
Regional bloc ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, imposed sanctions on Mali after a special summit on January 9th held in Accra. ECOWAS has already sanctioned members of Mali's military government and threatened further sanctions if they did not abide by a formally agreed-upon election date of February 2022. In December, Malian leaders proposed holding the next presidential elections in 2026. Malian President Assimi Goïta said that he remains open to further dialogue with ECOWAS to find a solution, despite illegitimate, illegal, and inhumane decisions by the regional bloc, and urged them to reconsider sanctions. He says, "We call on ECOWAS once again for a thorough analysis of the situation in our country, placing the best interests of the Malian population above all other considerations." Salimata Koulibaly, like more than 70% of Malians, works in the informal sector. After finishing school, she was unemployed and opened a shop with her family selling used appliances, children's toys, and clothes brought by shipping container from France via Senegal. This merchandise will not be able to pass into Mali, along with other non-essential goods, while the sanctions are in place. Salimata and her family rely on the store's income for basic living expenses. Right now, she says, everything we do depends on the store. If we can't get the containers here, it's going to get us into trouble. Frankly, it will really get us into trouble. But we pray to God that ECOWAS and Mali can find an agreement so that all this is over. Kobi Annan, a risk consultant based in Accra with Songhai Advisory, a firm that does political and economic risk analyses in sub-Saharan Africa, says that Senegal is Mali's biggest import partner. He says that the widespread support of the military government in Mali will play a role in how Malian citizens view the sanctions.
People will probably be willing to take a bit of suffering for a kind of patriotic stand to show that Mali will not just back down in the face of opposition from ECOWAS. So I think they will get to a point where it will start to get difficult. You know, Mali is an import-heavy economy. They do well relatively in terms of food subsistence, but other things have to be imported. And as a landlocked country, that's especially difficult if your land borders are closed.
Guinea's military junta released a televised statement Monday affirming the country's support for Mali and stating that borders between Mali and neighboring Guinea will remain open. Guinea's former president Alpha Condé was ousted in a coup d'etat in September 2021, and the country has been under military rule since. ECOWAS has mounted pressure on Guinea to return to constitutional rule. An open border with Guinea, just 130 kilometers southwest of Bamako, gives Mali access to the port of Conakry. Annie Reisenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
The UN Human Rights Office says it is seriously concerned about the deteriorating human rights situation in Tunisia and is calling on the government to protect and respect the rights and freedoms of its people. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
One of the latest gross violations occurred on December 31st. On that day, two men, one a member of parliament and former justice minister, and the second man, a former interior ministry official, were snatched from their homes by men in plain clothes. They subsequently were bundled into cars and driven away without any explanation to unknown destinations. UN Human Rights spokeswoman Liz Throssell says the MP, Nuruddin Biri, subsequently was put under house arrest. Since he has a heart condition, he has been transferred to a hospital where he remains under guard. The second man taken away, identified in media reports as Fatih Baldi, is now under house arrest. Throssell says the men reportedly are suspected of terrorism-related offenses, though neither has been formally charged.
Although the men's families and the UN Human Rights Office in Tunisia have since been able to visit them, these two incidents echo practices not seen since the Ben Ali era and raise serious questions regarding abduction, enforced disappearance, and arbitrary detention.
The UN Rights Office is urging Tunisian authorities to promptly release the men or charge them according to due process standards for criminal proceedings. Following violent demonstrations on September 1st, spokeswoman Throssell says President Kais Saied called on the country's internal security forces to change their practices and respect the rights and freedoms of the Tunisian people. However, she notes authorities have yet to translate their words into action.
As well as the actions of the internal security forces, we are concerned at the stifling of dissent in Tunisia, including through the improper use of counter-terrorism legislation, and the increasing use of military courts to try civilians, which raise serious concerns regarding the equitable, impartial, and independent administration of justice.
Officials say Tunisia has made tremendous progress toward promoting and realizing human rights over the past decade. They urge authorities to continue that pathway. They call on them to reform the security and justice sectors so they are fully compliant with Tunisia's international human rights obligations. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The East African Community member states are set to recognize COVID-19 certificates from partner states to ease the free movement of goods and people in the region. This comes after the Council of Ministers met to resolve challenges affecting the transborder trade in the region due to the pandemic. Moses Havyarimana reports.
On Monday, the East African Community Council of Ministers met to discuss the truck driver's crisis and agreed to recognize the negative COVID-19 tests from accredited laboratories in the partner states. John Bosco Kalisa is the chief executive officer of the East African Business Council.
The decision that was made yesterday is a commendable one. We appreciate all the ministers from the ES partners in terms of ensuring that the movement of goods is facilitated and unhindered during this period where there is an introduction of the new measures to contain the spread of the new virus.
Fred Mukasambide is a lawmaker from the East African community. He says that the introduction of the COVID-19 pass is a milestone in respecting common market protocol.
The ESC pass is going to be a good development. Because it establishes a common trust network that supports, obviously, digital access to health data. Of course, now these ones have replaced the otherwise archaic and compunctious processes where each partner state would definitely do its own testing.
George Odong, a lawmaker from Uganda, talks on the recognition of the national laboratories by the East African Community member states.
Some of these laboratories are not very much regulated, in my opinion. So to come up with a list of laboratories that have been inspected and verified by a team of experts is a very good way to, you know, to harmonize the standards.
Traders and truck drivers were mostly impacted by the COVID-19 measures imposed by the partner states while crossing borders. One of the regional transborder traders hailed the community's move for a harmonized COVID-19 certificate.
It will be very easy to reach Nairobi without delaying on the way. For example, if you get a COVID certificate here in Burundi, you go to Kabanga, you just show, you continue. You reach Mutukulu, you just show, you continue. Malawa, Busha, you just show, you continue. It's very easier compared to each border point. You take 1 hour, 2 hours, 1 hour, 2 hours. So that it has been very tiresome.
As the East African community is struggling to recover the economy that has been affected by the pandemic since 2020, many sectors like tourism are still struggling. That led the community to lose about $4.8 billion in the year 2020. Moses Havyarimana for Voice of America.
Voice of America!
And still in East Africa, Kenyans are calling for a boycott of the fast food giant KFC after it announced that it was facing a shortage of potatoes to make its popular French fries. In a statement, KFC said the shortage was the result of supply chain delays caused by the pandemic. Now, even though potatoes are Kenya's second most consumed food crop, KFC says that local farmers don't meet its quality assurance standards. However, after Kenyans, especially on social media, expressed their displeasure using memes and the hashtag #BoycottKFC trending on Twitter, the company promised to start working with local potato suppliers. Kevin Kamau is the CEO of Tukalime, a Kenyan farm management company. He joins me via phone from Nairobi and tells me that compared to other fast food restaurants, KFC is still popular, especially among young Kenyans.
When I look at the prices, that actually I call it the chicken wars, and between them, Java House Africa, we have Chicken Inn here. It's different guys. I mean, it's almost like a race to the bottom in terms of price wars. But in terms of popularity, yeah, especially with the younger generation, it's a big hit, you know. Actually, when KFC opened here, I was actually in the US. I was studying in the US. And I remember seeing lines because people were just like, KFC's in Kenya. And it's a beloved brand, that's for sure.
Would you say there's a shortage of potatoes and that could perhaps explain why KFC doesn't source local potatoes?
No, I wouldn't say there's a shortage. Although different seasons, sometimes you get shortages of potatoes. But this time around, we don't have a shortage of potatoes. KFC has been around for the last 10 years, if I'm not wrong. And, you know, the biggest issue, because I remember about a couple of years ago when the issue came about them importing potatoes, it wasn't a big deal, you know. But then the issue is when we find farmers throwing away a lot of potatoes that are not being used into the system, then it really, really hurts because that means there's enough potatoes for them to be able to buy to process their needs.
Where does KFC source its potatoes currently?
You know, in the beginning, there were news reports about Egypt, but currently I think it's the Netherlands, if I'm not wrong.
How is it that over a decade of operating in Kenya, KFC has not found a local supplier that meets its standards?
You know, and that's the biggest beef. I mean, the thing is, you know, we all love KFC, you know, the kids love KFC and all that stuff. And the biggest issue is in that 10 years, I believe if the Kenyan standards are not desirable, I believe they should have invested in capacity building for our farmers to be able to reach those higher standards, because we want to reach those higher standards. The reason why like KFC works in a country like Kenya is because it's aspirational, you know, the things that we grew up seeing in the movies and stuff like that. So if we look at it as a sign of quality, you know, then I believe they should have given back to the Kenyan farmers and help them build capacity for them to be able to produce that level of quality.
And what kind of pushback did KFC face locally after it was discovered that it doesn't source local potatoes? How did Kenyan social media especially react?
Yeah, I mean, social media is very, very powerful just because you'll get bombarded. And they've really been kicked the last week or so. You know, I'm sure you've seen the memes, you know, when people or a foreign entity kind of attacks one of your own, and attacks, I put in quotes, just because it's not a direct attack, it's attacking type of shunning, saying you're not good enough for us. So you see people look inwards, and I've been seeing the memes, people looking at, you know, the fries we grew up in, because I was born and raised in Kenya, you know, I don't think they had any QA guidelines. And guys are saying that this, we were born with this, and it's okay, we love our homegrown fries. I don't know why you're trying to tell us that you need this.
They're not good enough.
They're not good enough. And they did remove a statement that they will be allowing Kenyan farmers to be able to supply them. Now, the only caveat that I saw on another article is that they will be open for Kenyan farmers to do so, but they are not willing to share their QA standards or something like that. So I was like, how does that work then? You know, it's almost like, fine, you've allowed me to be able to supply, but then I will still won't show you our quality guidelines. It's kind of, it's a give and take. I really do wish that the leadership at KFC Kenya could just come out and have a sit down and talk to people, not necessarily with me, with anybody, because I think not saying or not being able to have a back and forth and come to a solution just doesn't look good. You know, again, we love the brand, but then just keeping quiet and removing statements actually does not do well for the brand.
That was Kevin Kamau, CEO of Tukalime, a Kenyan farm management company. I reached him in Nairobi. In Nigeria, the education sector was one of the hardest hit by the COVID-19 pandemic, but the effect was particularly pronounced in the higher education sector as public universities struggled to shift their activities online following the pandemic-induced lockdown. And part of the reason has been attributed to weak internet access and infrastructure. Although schools have since resumed, the impact of the pandemic continues to be felt by students who struggled to cope after months at home. From Lagos, Samuel Okocha has this report.
When we just gained admission, the time was just too short for us to catch up.
Aminu Leilat is a first-year student at the Lagos State Polytechnic. She said because of the late resumption of academic activities, our school had to shorten the academic calendar to make up for lost time during the pandemic-induced lockdown.
And our academic session was just fast. Like, they didn't give us enough space to read. So they just, yes, it was rushed and it affected my performance.
Leilat is not alone. Her story is shared by Tamiyu Rashid, a 400-level student of the Kwara State University, currently in Lagos on an internship.
It was just 1 week to go and read by yourself and just exam straightforward. So just did the exam and though there was something like a mass failure, but still some of us passed regardless.
The experiences of students like Rashid and Leilat highlight the inability of public universities to undertake academic work remotely during the heat of COVID-19. That's according to Dr. Adedeji Oyenuga, a lecturer at the Department of Sociology at the Lagos State University.
Public schools cannot go online. Now, the teachers may not be trained well enough to understand how to operate online. We're not talking about an advanced nation where hybrid is allowed. Here, we have to do it real time. And when we were online, even my own university, for example, students were not coming to class because they tell you that my data. And my university, when they wanted to reimburse those who use data, they gave it to only HODs and professors. The people that were using data did not get anything from the university, so they did not encourage other lecturers to use the online platform.
Again, at the Lagos State University, Dr. Adenuga adds that on return to school, students struggled to perform during the examinations because of the lapses suffered at the height of the pandemic.
So things didn't work the way it was meant to work. And as a result, in my university, for example, that semester after the COVID was terrible. Results very poor because we had to come out and then within a very short period, we had to prepare students for examination. Very difficult, and then they couldn't cope.
COVID-19 has been tough for all Nigerian higher education institutions, but one bright spot remains, and that's the fact that universities are now developing remote learning capacities that will stand them in good stead in the future. Samuel Okocha, VOA News, Lagos, Nigeria.
And that's it for this edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. For more African news and features, visit our website at voanews.com. We are also on all social media platforms. We are on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Just search for VOA Africa. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good morning, Africa.